everybody, and welcome to the Lit Sot podcast, where books are lighthouses in the sea of time. Today on the podcast, I have Isabel, as usual, but today we also have a special guest for you. Her name is Jolie, and she is here from Sandpoint, Idaho? That's pretty cool. Go ahead and Greetings. Introduce yourself, Jolie.
Hi, I'm Jolie, as Gabriel has said. Cool. I'm taking a Macbeth class with Isabel currently, which is why I'm here.
Yes, because right. we're going to discuss...
That's what we're talking about today. We are going to be discussing Shakespeare's play Macbeth. And, this is going to be a very in-depth episode. Like Jolie said, both Isabel and her have been taking a class on this play specifically. So we'll have lots of expert knowledge today. So that should be fun. I'd love to just jump right into this big discussion and start talking about Macbeth himself, the central character. But I suppose first we should go ahead and do a summary of the entire play if you've never actually heard of Macbeth or even know who that is. So Isabel, go ahead and take it away.
All right, so we are introduced first to three witches who are completely nasty beings. And they're talking, and then Macbeth turns up on the scene. He's a general in the Scottish army, and he comes fresh from battle where he has just killed the traitor who tried to betray the king and usurp his throne. So Macbeth has just covered himself in the glory of battle, and he and another general, Banquo, happen upon these witches, and the witches hail Macbeth with a prophecy, which starts our action going. They say, "All hail Macbeth, Thane of Glamis. All hail Macbeth, Thane of Cawdor. And all hail Macbeth, King that will be." So they prophesy that he's going to be king. And Banquo is shocked by this, and he says, "Wait, tell something about me, if you can tell the future." And they say, it's Macduff, not Banquo. Where am I? Macduff?
No, it's Banquo.
No, it's Banquo.
Yeah, it is Banquo.
Banquo, sorry. Banquo, your children will be kings, although you won't be. So Macbeth is very interested in this prophecy, and he starts thinking about this right away, you know. How could I possibly, you know, what is this all about? And then messengers arrive after the witches disappear and tell him that he is Thane of Cawdor. He's been named Thane of Cawdor. So part of their prophecy is fulfilled. So he wonders, well, what the heck? I could be king. So he sends a letter to his wife, and then we switch back to his castle, and his wife gets this letter. And right away, she learns of this prophecy, and she says, "All right, we're going to kill the king. I'm going to, I'm kind of afraid that my husband's has too much of a conscience to do this, but I'm going to talk him into it." So he comes home with the king, and everybody's going to stay at his palace, at his castle. And Lady Macbeth tells her husband, "We're doing this tonight before King Duncan leaves in the morning." And Macbeth doesn't want to do it. He wants out. But she said, "You're a coward if you don't do this." So in the middle of the night, when everybody's asleep, they take daggers. And which this is interesting. Lady Macbeth is the one who takes care of all the details and planning. And just before they're about to do it, Macbeth sees this vision of a dagger, and that's the famous scene, I'm sure everybody knows it. "Is that a dagger which I see before me, the handle towards my hand?" Everybody knows that quote, right? So he, although he's reluctant and he's tortured by his conscience, he goes ahead and he kills, Macbeth kills Duncan. And then they make it look like the grooms are responsible. Lady Macbeth plants evidence and blood on them. And then they go back to sleep. But I forget who discovers it. Is it Macduff? I believe it's Macduff. Discovers the murder, and everybody comes out, and, you know, both of the Macbeths act like huge hypocrites, saying, "What? A murder in our house?" All that sort of thing. And the king's heirs fly because they're afraid of being murdered themselves, so everybody presumes that the grooms have murdered, being bribed by Malcolm, Duncan's son, who flees. So Macbeth is a cousin of Duncan. And so he is nominated for the throne. So he gets it. But there's a catch. He's tormented by what he's done. I forget what happens next. Something about Banquo. So he remembers the prophecy that Banquo's sons are going to be on the throne and not him. So, accordingly, he pays some people to murder Banquo's and his son. And at the royal banquet, Banquo's ghost shows up, all bloody and murdered. And Macbeth makes this huge scene in the middle of everything, in front of everybody. So, basically, everything's a mess. Everybody leaves the banquet hall. And Macbeth rushes off to consult the witches to see what's happened, and they give him three additional prophecies that no man born of woman shall hurt him, and that he will never be defeated until he should fear Macduff, and that he will never be defeated until Birmingham's Wood marches to, I forget the name of the hill, but it's a
Burnham Wood gets up and till Burnham Wood removed to Dunsinane. I cannot think here.
Dunsinane. Thank you. That. And so everybody is starting to suspect Macbeth. Things are going downhill, and Macbeth's going crazy. You know, he's seen this ghost. He's in a terrible wreck with his conscience and everything. And Macduff goes off to try to seek for remedy with some consult with other people in England. So Macbeth goes nuts. He's supposed to fear Macduff. So he slaughters Macduff's wife and children, which completely enrages everybody with half a brain. And they all start converging to try to overthrow Macbeth. But Macbeth is convinced that nobody's going to hurt him till this wood moves to this hill. And so he doesn't pay all that much attention to it. But of course, what happens is the prophecy comes true because the people who are waiting, the people who are attacking, use branches of this wood as a shield as they march up the hill. So in a sense, the wood does come to the hill. And Macduff faces off with Macbeth saying, "You've killed my wife and children. What in the world is wrong with you? Stand down." And Macbeth said, "No man born of woman can kill me." And then Macduff says, "I was not born. I was plucked from my mother's womb." You know, like a C-section. And so he kills Macbeth, and there's the end to it. Oh, I missed the bit where just before the final showdown battle, Lady Macbeth goes bonkers as well, and she starts sleepwalking and trying to wash her hands of the blood and the guilt, but of course she can't in her sleep. That's very key to that's really important. And at the very end, she kills herself. The end.
Great summary.
Thank you.
Yeah. Cool. So, yeah. So Macbeth, like who is he? Like, obviously he has some sort of a conscience, right? Like, I mean, he does this terrible thing and then like he just goes crazy about it because like he just did this terrible, awful thing. I mean, I feel like most, you know, stereotypical supervillains, you know, wouldn't quite get so, you know, messed up about just, you know, killing somebody in their quest for power. But, I don't know. So, but I mean, on the other hand, he did really do some pretty terrible stuff. So, I mean, like, is he like a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Like, is he somewhere in between? Where does he fall on that spectrum? What do you guys think?
Well, I think it's important to kind of classify this play as the fall of a tragic hero kind of a play. And so in order for that to work, he needs to be a hero, and he needs to fall in a way that we can empathize with.
Right.
So, you know, in the beginning, he comes out as this courageous guy hot off the battlefield. And he kind of gets dragged into being a bad guy, in a sense. Like, what do you think about that, Julie?
I would say he's villainous, but he's not a villain. He's does bad things, but he's not entirely irredeemable.
Gotcha. Right. So he's a believable villain.
Right. Yes. And I think the power of the emotion, the emotional power comes from the fact that he had so many opportunities to go back, but he didn't, although he wanted to, but he went on in spite of himself, which really? Kind of makes it
right. Like when?
Well,
where's that one where I am steeped in blood that to go forward would be as difficult as going back?
Right, right. But to go back would be as tedious as to go or.
Yes.
So he's, but that's later on in the play. In the very beginning, we see him when he's talking to his wife. Here, let me pull up the quote for you. Just give me a second. When he's talking with his wife, who is trying to persuade him to do this, she says, summarizing a huge chunk, if you're not willing to do this, you're a coward. Would you rather live a coward in your own estimation? And he says, I dare do all that may become a man. Who dares do more is none. You know, he has this sense that it's more important to be just than merely brave. But she said, well, I dare do it. And she has this really horrible speech that, I have given suck, and I know how tender it is to love the babe that milks me. But had I so sworn, I would have dashed him to his brains out, essentially. And that Macbeth is just a complete coward for not daring to do something that she, a woman, would dare to do. And so then he goes in with it because of these insults and, you know, calling him a coward. But he tells her that he doesn't want to. You know, we will go no further in this business. He hath honored me of late, Duncan, and I have bought golden opinions from all sorts of people, which ought to be worn now when they are in their newest gloss, then cast aside so soon. Mm-hmm. But he goes into it, and he also has this spectacular, this dagger scene. I thought the dagger scene was really neat. Because if you notice, there's no blood on it till he grasps at the handle, you know?
Mm.
That's pretty significant.
Gotcha. Okay, so you're talking about how he has several opportunities to go back, as it were, to, you know, not grasp the handle. So, I don't know, in a lot of tragedies, fate plays a big role, and there's definitely a role in this one, too. You know, you have the prophecy at the beginning, but how does this differ from some of the other fated books we read, like for instance, Oedipus? You know, because Macbeth receives a prophecy and like tries to fulfill it, and Oedipus, as we discussed in a previous episode, he got a prophecy and tried to do everything he could to not fulfill it, and it still came true. So I guess, do you think this prophecy would still have come true had Macbeth not taken such desperate means to achieve it?
I suspect that it would have, because looking at the prophecies, they're specific, but they're vague enough that Macbeth's actions aren't the only course of action that is possible.
Right.
If he had waited, I mean, it was a warlike culture. It was possible. Duncan was old. Duncan would have died of natural causes soon enough.
Right.
His sons might have died in battle. It was a natural thing. Mm-hmm. And if they had all three died without heirs, he would have taken the throne without any killing anybody else.
Hmm. Gotcha. Okay, then so is Macbeth and Lady Macbeth's ambition a bad thing? And is ambition a bad thing in general?
Well, I think the key thing is that they're using the prophecy as an excuse to do something immoral.
Oh, okay.
And so the you know, witches are satanic in medieval superstition and lore. I've read several fairy tales in which they are clearly, you know, they dance with the devil, all of this stuff. You know, the only way to defeat them is with holy water, that kind of superstitious gobbledygook.
Right.
So, witches in that time, the lore was that they were women who had made a deal with the devil in return for the devil's powers. So they were inherently satanic.
Right, right. And so they're acting in this situation like tempters to tempt Macbeth to try to get his soul, in a way. Not that explicitly, but they want him to fall. And so they're giving him prophecies which bait him to do stuff he shouldn't do. And this is interesting because Banquo even spots this. And he says, oh golly, where'd it go? And oftentimes, to win us to our harm, the instruments of darkness tell us truths, win us with honest trifles, to betray us in deepest consequence. So he tells Macbeth the prophecy about Thane of Cawdor to win his trust and to try to get him to go further and to kill for the throne. You know, they're very manipulative. So it's... Of course he didn't have to. He wasn't impelled by fate to kill.
Right.
It was a choice he made.
Right. And interestingly, he switches later when there are the three other prophecies. In the case of Banquo, he tries everything he can do to keep that prophecy from coming true.
Right.
So whereas he tried to fulfill it in the first instance, now he's trying to make sure it doesn't happen. So
he kind of loses his excuse that, you know, murdering Duncan, it was fated to happen. He had to, because mm-hmm. by trying to kill Banquo, he proved that he didn't believe the prophecies were absolutely going to happen.
Right.
So right. he kind of lost his virtue almost retroactively, whatever he might have mm-hmm. laid claim to.
Right, right. I mean, he's completely self-serving with this. So it's less about fate, per se, and more about Macbeth's struggle with good and evil, with his own self, basically.
So it's not about the prophecy, it's about how he responds to the prophecy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And that would be interesting to talk about how he does respond to the prophecy. Like, what would you say, guys, at what point is he fixed? At what point can he never go back?
I don't know. At no point? I don't know. I feel like at some point any character can, like, you know, kind of go contrary to what he's been doing at any point and just kind of turn around and go, okay, I'm done now. this was stupid, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, are you more asking, like, at which point would he never consider doing that?
At which point could, like, what was the last moment when he could have repented, to put it in those terms?
Trying to think.
You know, this is such a weird thing. I want to contrast these two quotes from Lady Macbeth and her husband, Macbeth. Because as soon as she hears, as soon as she reads the letter, there's this bizarre quote from her that she says, she has this long speech. "Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, and unsex me here, and fill me from crown to the toe, tap full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood, stop up the access and passage to remorse, that no compunctious visitings of nature shall shake my fell purpose, nor keep peace between the effect and it." And it goes on for quite a bit. But she even invokes hell. "Come, thick night, and palm me in the dunnest smoke of hell, that my keen knife not see the wound it makes, nor heaven peep through the blanket of the dark to cry, hold, hold." And I find it interesting because she's basically saying, she's basically calling on the wicked powers to destroy her conscience.
Right.
But Macbeth does that too.
Really?
He does that. Yeah. Yeah, he does. He does it before he kills Banquo, his second murder. So the first murder, he has cold feet, right? But the second murder. "Come, sealing night, scarf up the tender eye of pitiful day, and with thy blood and bloody and invisible hand, cancel and tear to pieces that great bond which keeps me pale." Well, he called on night to cancel and tear to pieces the great bond which keeps him pale, which is his conscience, right? So
right.
He mutes his conscience too, but not till the second murder.
Huh.
So it's interesting because that's the point, in my opinion, when he stops being dragged into it by his wife and the prophecy and all these other circumstances
right.
that are kind of, you know, pushing him about. And that's when he kind of puts his own feet down and chooses evil for himself. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah,
I would agree.
Yeah, I don't really see any point like after that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I love at the end where like, you know, the prophecy, you know, it's reveals like, oh hey, you know, this guy wasn't born. I love that as a literary device. It's
it's just
so fun. I love it in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
I like it there. What are some other books that have that?
I don't know, where the prophecy turns out to be quite different, or it fulfilled in a different sense than you expect.
Right. Then again, that's almost like every book with a prophecy. But like, it's a cool like plot twist when you think it's impossible, but it turns out. And then the same thing with the wood, you know, how it like you know, it comes to the hill.
Well, you know, I saw Macbeth for the first time as an opera. And
really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was written into an opera by Verdi, who is one of the four most popular composers for opera. And that was like the most amazing part of the whole thing was when he brandishes the dagger, and then he has this very amazing musical line where he says that line, "I was plucked untimely from my mother's womb," and then kills him, and then it's like the finale of the whole thing. So that's a pretty amazing, pretty amazing climax.
Yeah, one version I saw of Macbeth was. It was a movie version. They set it in World War I, and they put Sir Patrick Stewart as Captain Picard as Macbeth. That was cool. In that one, the witches end up being like these nurses. Yeah, it's kind of a weird
That's
scene.
Disgusting.
That was probably the stretchiest part of trying to set it in World War I times. But it was. I liked the banquet scene in that one. Like, Sir Patrick Stewart is just fantastic in that. It was just like, you know, we're seeing the ghost of, Banquo. But, I wish I could show you that scene because it's some phenomenal acting.
Right. We should return to the play version, though. It's just very interesting. The contrast between Lady Macbeth and Macbeth.
Yes.
Because this was a controversy on our class, actually.
Really?
Some people say they're on inversed paths, and that Lady Macbeth starts out completely evil and becomes progressively more and more good, citing her sleepwalking as kind of the example.
Right.
But in my mind, they're on parallel paths, you know, with the prophecy being at the beginning.
Right.
Hardening their conscience, like I kind of described with those two quotes, being in the middle. And then at the end, the psychic break with Macbeth, it being the ghost, and Lady Macbeth, the sleepwalking.
Right.
But a lot of people, like, everybody actually disagree with me. So what do you guys think about that? That's like, I'm still confused about this.
Yeah, what do you think, Jolie? You are in the class.
I agree with Isabel on, like, the progression of what they do.
Uh-huh.
Where I would disagree is I'd say in terms of guilt, Macbeth, like, starts out guilty almost before they even do the act he's guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And gets progressively less guilty. Well, Macbeth starts out pretty much not caring. And as the play goes on, starts to feel more and more guilty and feel her conscience pressing on her.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Well,
mm-hmm.
I mean, one obvious difference between Macbeth and Lady Macbeth is their gender difference, and I think that's an important thing to touch on at some point. Shakespeare has a lot of good lines in here about, like, you know, when Lady Macbeth calls upon the murdering spirits to unsex me here, you know, what So I guess what sort of things does Shakespeare try to say about men and women? Because both Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are pretty vicious.
Dummy.
in this play. But do you think what are some of the things he tries to say through this play?
You want to take a crack at it first, Jolie? I don't think I actually read your response to that one.
Yeah, so, I know I read yours at some point, but I don't remember what you said.
Well,
all right, you tell me what you wrote, and I'll tell you what I wrote. That will be a lovely way to answer this question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wrote mostly that while there were some, like, traditional gender roles with women being more feminine, men being more masculine, it kind of blurred the lines.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, at first, Lady Macbeth was actually the more masculine of their relationship in terms of just the stereotypical gender roles. It was pretty interesting. Right. It was also the most controversial question out of class, I would say.
Oh, by far. People wrote lots of silly stuff.
Like, yes. What?
Oh, you know, the whole Shakespearean times were misogynist thing.
Yes, there was somebody who really flipped out at the end of hers.
Yeah. I didn't bother reading all of the responses, but it took me a while to find one that I could stand replying to. But I think what he's saying has less to do with social justice, which is the angle that most people sail into this with, the social justice thing, and more to do with character traits.
I would definitely agree.
Right, because men had to be brave, and women, it's like a matter of emphasis, compassion. Women need compassion to, you know, raise their families and everything, and the men need courage to protect, you know? And that's actually the weapon Lady Macbeth uses against Macbeth all the time. Her favorite trump card is, you're a coward not to do this. You're a coward. And of course,
it was actually like, wasn't there that line, when you darest do it, then you were a man?
Yes. Yes. And also, when he sees the ghost, she asks him, are you a man? fie on you, you know, this tale of this ghost is fit to be an old woman's story by the fireside. She plays that card constantly. And she, of course, what does she ask the spirits is for them to take away her compassion, basically. Right. So, in my mind, Shakespeare's saying two things. One, very obviously, it's being a man is not all about being brave. It's mostly about being good, which shouldn't come as a shock to anybody. And also, I think people who divulge from the formula of, you know, compassion and courage, if they're doing so for selfish reasons, are going to come to a bad end.
Right. I think. I mean, talking about masculinity here, I think. Mm-hmm. I think goodness and bravery are most often needed because, in order to be good, you have to be brave, and I think that's kind of right. Where that kind of came from.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what also kind of I thought of when I was reading through this is just how absolutely just terrible Lady Macbeth seems at the beginning. Like, she's just like yikes. Like, you get really scared of her. She's really vicious sounding. Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And it reminded me of what in the fact that Macbeth isn't, you know, that, so at least at the beginning, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it reminded me of what one of my, high school teacher friends said.
Uh-huh.
He said that, he works at like this public school and, so I don't remember how it came up, but we started talking about fights, you know, when students get into fights and so somehow he talked about like guy fights and girl fights and how wildly different they were and how, whenever guys fought, there would be rules. You know, mm-hmm. there would be, you know, like there's fighting dirty and you don't do that, you know?
Yeah.
But that whenever like girls would fight, there would be absolutely no holds barred. Like, you know, there'd be like hair being ripped out. There'd be like this, just crazy, like rah. So I guess is Shakespeare trying to say something like that? Is that possibly something you could pull out of the text there? And do you think that's in any way accurate?
Wow, that's something I hadn't thought about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose. I suppose that would do it. I mean,
that could definitely be an interpretation.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
Right. And she went kind of nuts out of self-interest, though. You know, she wanted to be queen. Basically.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there was no holds barred for that. And it's really, she wasn't sloppy though. She attended to all those details. You know, like when you see girls have those nasty fights, they're like not even in control of themselves anymore.
Right.
So, and you don't really see that here. That's one difference, true. Maybe. She keeps full possession of her faculties.
Yeah.
But you're right, there is that savagery. She's a nasty character.
Yes.
Ah. But the play would be rubbish without her.
Oh, yeah, very true.
And we went and saw this live, and my mom's sole comment on the Metro ride home was she shook her fingers at Richard and Nathaniel, my two brothers, and she said, "He wouldn't have done it if it weren't for her, boys. Remember that. You always pick the right woman. A wrong woman will ruin you." And their marriage is quite a factor to consider in the play. It must have been an awful marriage. I mean, from what we see of it. I mean, there's just these two people trying to get as much as they can from each other.
Right. They're both takers.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's interesting to watch their relationship progress as the play goes on, because she has all this influence over him in the beginning and makes him do, she manipulates him into doing what she wants him to do. But towards the end, she kind of loses that, you know.
Yeah.
I think you especially see that in the scene where he sees Banquo's ghost, because she plays the same arguments, you know, are you a man?
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't work this time. So, like, what do you think? What do you think changed? Did Macbeth change? Did Lady Macbeth change? What caused that?
I think they both kind of changed.
Hmm.
In what way?
Well, I mean, they committed a murder. That's not something the human psyche is generally made to be able to stand.
Right.
Right.
So, I mean, their attitudes, their behavior, it's going to change. And I think Macbeth definitely became more bloodthirsty and
right.
a bit more stubborn as well. Like she made me do this. She's not somebody I'm going to listen to anymore, even though he's still doing the same things that at first she compelled him to do.
Right.
He still lost respect for her.
Yeah, respect. Okay. Yeah, that's pretty key.
Yeah, and I think also there, I feel like one of the reasons why, like, the argument of, like, you know, come on, be a man, you know, that kind of, like, the why that doesn't work anymore is because he's, well, for a couple reasons. First of all, I mean, he's already done the ultimate, like, what in her mind was, you know, like, manliness, you know, just,
right.
just doing an act without, you know, without conscience, without, you know, and also I think maybe he's kind of realized that, like, okay, right, what you're calling me to be here, this isn't really manliness, so you don't know what you're talking about, just shut up.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because I think his ambition is more nuanced than hers.
Yeah.
Her ambition was for the throne, end of story.
Right.
But, like, listen to, like, his ambition involved good opinion, respect,
right.
actually. Because he says to his wife, we will go no further in this business. He has honored me of late, and I have won golden opinions from all kinds of people, and so on and so forth. But then in the end, like, before he goes to his death, he has this speech of how he's wasted his life, and all he can expect in his old age are curses.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he's just bitter and savage. And that's the same scene when the doctors are telling him about how his wife is sleepwalking and she's sick and they can't cure her. And he's just acting very irritable and dismissive and like, damn your medicine, cure her or do whatever. But just, you know, I'm going off to war now, you know, so that's a complete utter lack of love of any description right there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, maybe those things are kind of related.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Mm. It just didn't pay for him. I mean, she got what she wanted. She couldn't enjoy it, really. But
right.
he never got what he wanted. Because what he was acting as if, or like, he wasn't acknowledging to himself that he wanted respect, which comes from good morals,
right.
maybe even more than he actually wanted the throne.
Maybe that's kind of why that argument worked at the beginning, you know, like, you know, mm-hmm. be a man, you know, he was trying mm-hmm. to get respect from his wife.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And, you know, I think fundamentally he's such a narcissist.
You know? Yes. He cares about himself. He doesn't really care what happens to elevate himself.
Right. And he says that himself when he goes off to consult the witches. For mine own good, all causes shall give way. you know, he's the center of everything. And Hecate, we haven't touched on her. She's like she's in charge of the witches, basically. She says Macbeth loves for his own ends and not for the witches.
And that's kind of true for all of his relationships, not just for the witches.
I don't know. I never really got narcissism from Macbeth. I mean, any more than that would be normal in a person. Like, at some point, we all are, you know, concerned for our own, like, ends. Obviously that thing where but at that point, he's already, like...
crazy. Right.
Right. Like, is there any, like, you know, sane Macbeth lines where he's, like, you know, seeming very selfish?
Think about why he doesn't want to murder. He's chiefly concerned with the effect that it has on his own psyche. He knows that it's horrible, but he's more alive to, like, the dramatic flair, the blood, guts, and gore kind of... I will be thinking about this forever than he is about the fact that Duncan is a human who has his own life and loves and ambitions too. And he slaughters the grooms whom he framed for the murder without even really thinking about it. He never acts guilty about that. They weren't important to him. You know?
But Duncan was.
I know, Duncan was. But he never really shows concern that he's done Duncan wrong. He never talks about how he wronged Duncan or Banquo. He talks about how it's haunting him. It's all about himself and the effect that it has on his own conscience and soul. Without any regard for the relatives or the way that he's destroying people around him. And he shows no concern for his wife once she's not useful to him. And just throughout, the hallmark of a narcissist is that other people, unconsciously to them, just simply aren't as complex and valid, and they're not as completely, they're not as relevant, and
that's human nature, count. Not narcissism.
Right, but if you think about it, narcissism is that you can't take in insults, you know, so this was so important to him that his wife was calling him a coward. Now, seriously, most people can just tell somebody that they're wrong, and their opinion at some point is not... She was insulting his ego, which pushed him over the edge. That was the blow that started him on the wrong path, was all about flattering his ego. The prophecy, you know, the ambition is all related to this, that what he wants is more important than a regard for the basic fundamental well-being of other humans around him. So that's why I would call him a narcissist, and that would, like, kind of almost as a tragic flaw, really, that he can't look beyond himself to kind of see other people as counting.
I guess I would say he's more prideful than narcissistic. For me, narcissism is more of a exaggerated sort of a thing. Like someone is narcissistic. If someone is narcissistic, it's painfully obvious. I didn't really get that with Macbeth. I would say he's more prideful, and I don't know if there's really a difference there, but like I feel more comfortable saying that he was prideful than he was narcissistic. Why is that?
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, he was definitely prideful, that's for sure. Yeah.
And he definitely only cared about his own ends.
Right. He was definitely self-seeking. Yeah. And I think that's just the thing that tipped the moral dominoes, was that you don't necessarily have to call it narcissism, but the fundamental motivation for committing murder
was the
selfishness and pride, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, okay. I figured out the source of my dilemma here. When you say narcissism, that's like... That's something that generally people don't admit to being, right? You know, like say, oh, I'm narcissistic, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, that's just a thing I am, right? That's just a thing that people don't do because that's like really kind of a big problem. It means you're kind of a jerk.
Right.
But I think everybody's a little bit prideful to some extent, right?
Right.
That's just how people are. So going that like, oh, well, Macbeth did this because like, you know, he was narcissistic. And I was like, no, because at some point, like, I can empathize with some of the feelings that he's feeling at certain times. And to mm-hmm. say that that's as large of a thing as narcissism made me go, well, maybe it's just pride. But I, at the end of the day, it's both whatever it was, it's what made him
right. commit and the murder. I think narcissism also has a narrow definition in that it's a term used by, I want to say psychologists. So I'm not using mm-hmm. it necessarily in that narrow sense. I don't even know what the precise definition is, but just. And I think, actually, I disagree with you, that the whole power of the play comes from the fact that everybody is selfish in this way, that you want what you want, regardless of how it affects others. And we don't necessarily all always act on it, but it's something that people are universally susceptible to and mm-hmm. have the struggle with. And I think that's why we emphasize so closely with Macbeth, is because, yes, pride maybe, but also selfishness is a human problem. Mm. The human problem, basically.
Right.
What was your take on the tragic flaw aspect, Julie?
I would agree with you that it was the selfishness. I think he wanted what he wanted, and if other people got hurt, well, that's just collateral damage, as long as he got what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I would completely agree with you.
Never really thought of what his tragic flaw was. Yeah, well, maybe a little bit of like not paying attention to consequences, right? Not like a lack of foresight, you know?
Right.
Which is funny because like he literally has prophecies of the future, but he has a lack of foresight.
Oh, does that sound familiar? It's really interesting, the contrasts between Oedipus Tyrannus and Macbeth. Have you ever read Oedipus Tyrannus, Julie?
I read, you're referring to the plays, correct?
Yes, from Sophocles.
I read the first one.
Oh. Right.
But I had this great literature class,
mm-hmm.
but we had to drop 6 weeks. Or Ooh. Whatever, so we didn't get to read that. All we did was the other what's it called? I can't remember the one, the Agamemnon, the death of Agamemnon, right. and the journey of his son. I can't remember what it's called.
That would be the Iliad.
No.
I'm sorry.
Sophocles did write a play about Agamemnon.
Oh, okay. We're still on stuff. Okay, got it. No, because we did this on the podcast earlier, but we won't get into it too much since you're not familiar with the contents of the play. But basically, it was another tragic hero, and he fell for very similar reasons, you know, putting too much stock in prophecies and...
prophecy that he would kill his father and marry his mother.
Yes, precisely. And he also had this trait of he was not very introspective, which kind of didn't get him very far. So, it's interesting that there seems to be this common theme of, people who don't know themselves well enough to accept their limitations and kind of guard against their own limitations, really. And he recognized his ambition. He said, I have nothing to spur my step, I paraphrase, except vaunting ambition, which I better just look it up.
Wait. Okay. Hang on. I just had a thought.
You had a thought.
I had a thought. Is ambition inherently selfish? And if so, can it ever be a good thing?
From the perspective of Shakespeare, or period point blank?
Just period point blank.
Probably not always a bad thing, but ambition for what? What is the object of ambition? I know, right? Because his ambition, you know, if you're ambitious to, maybe it's okay, but it can't be the beginning and end of your character. Because, like, Banquo's ambitious. You know, he asks about the sons being king. And he keeps that prophecy in mind. I think he brings it up later. You know, he's thinking about it. But he never does anything to act on it. And he never does anything immoral.
Right. So I guess, is there... like, what does healthy self-interest look like?
What's your take, Julie?
Well, it has to be self-interest combined with other virtues.
Right.
I mean, it isn't necessarily a bad thing to be like, oh, I want to be the CEO of company XYZ one day.
Right.
But if you do that through lying, cheating, stealing, bribery, blackmailing, etc., that's a bad thing.
Gotcha.
You have to have virtue as well as a desire to.
Well, so like self-interest is almost amoral because it depends on what kind of self you're interested in, right? If the person is interested in themselves and they're a good person, that's you know, well, then that's almost a good thing as opposed to, you know.
Well, if you can.
So it sort of magnifies whatever it is the person outright.
I suppose you're right. But I mean, let's put it this way. You're not a bad person. If you have opportunities to somehow better yourself in whatever respect where happens to be in question, you're not a bad person for taking the opportunity. You're a bad person if you claw your way and create opportunities unfairly for yourself.
Cool. All right. Well, we are starting to run up against time here. Are there any things that we definitely need to talk about that are very central to this? I mean, obviously, we only have about an hour, so we were only able to touch on a couple things, but are there any things that we should definitely discuss before closing out the podcast?
The blood bit was interesting.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Blood and darkness, I think, were two really prevalent imagery that were used throughout the play. You know, as a metaphor for guilt and responsibility.
Cool. Where's that come up?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you remember yourself the dagger scene. You know, the blood on the blade of the dagger, and both of the Macbeths have statements about blood and how it doesn't wash off. You know, Macbeth says after he's murdered Duncan, that all of great Neptune's ocean will never cleanse his hand. And Lady Macbeth says, will all the perfumes of Arabia could not sweeten this one little hand, you know? But also, Lady Macbeth tries to pin the guilt on the grooms by splitting blood on their faces. So, in the beginning of the play, it seems like blood for her is guilt for her. Not blood, but guilt for her is transferable. It's synonymous with punishment and blame, right? If you don't blame, if you don't get blamed for it, you're off scot-free. But that changes.
Right. The blood doesn't wash out.
Right. Right.
That has been used in so many cleaning commercials.
Yes.
Oh, golly. It's kind of a cliche at this point, almost. Right.
One thing I noticed with blood is that blood always seemed to come before something bad happened. Like, even the captain, the captain was injured and bloody.
Yeah.
And he brought the news that, well, Macbeth has done all these great things, which at the time sounds awesome, but if the captain hadn't said that, Duncan may not have chosen to, A, give Macbeth the title of Thane of Cawdor, and B, spend the night at his palace, which would have, either would have saved his life.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So blood just always seemed to show up before something bad happened.
And then when Banquo's ghost is all bloody too, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the apparitions, which gave the final three prophecies.
Yes, yes.
The second one was a bloody child, and he gave the prophecy about no man born of woman shall kill you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So he was bloody, and he was the one who said, this is how you're going to die, essentially.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Oh, and yeah, so speaking of that in particular encounter with the witches, there, I feel like the witches give us, like, all of our modern, like, you know, witchy, like, you know, that, like, this is what we think of as witches for, because of Shakespeare's Macbeth. You know, like, I have tongue of dog or whatever, like, all that stuff is, like, totally made up by Shakespeare, right?
Yep. Double, toil and trouble, fire burning, cauldron bubble.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah.
That
scene is always great in movies. Like, you know, it's just like, you know, super creepy and like Shakespeare knows what looks creepy, right? You know?
It's
cool.
Right. And also those beards. That was overanalyzed by everybody in the gender roles question.
Oh.
The beards, how the witches have beards. What was he saying about gender?
Shakespeare doesn't like...
He was saying they're ugly.
They're ugly and sinister and... Ugh.
Back in that time, ugliness was seen as a sign of moral...
Yes. Judged by appearances.
The beards weren't entirely... They had pretty much nothing to do with gender roles, but had more to do with physical appearance being a sign of your moral compass.
Right.
Yeah. Ugh. And they had very dubious morals.
Well, yes.
What? Just in medieval times or in Macbeth or the witches?
The witches.
Oh, yes. They're liver of blaspheming Jew, yeah, they have dubious morals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, interesting, though, that you should bring up the Jew, but the religious imagery and the whole heaven versus hell thing, I feel like we as modern readers don't necessarily delve into that. But I think it's really serious you have to realize that murder and suicide were two unforgivable ticket to hell sins, and everybody knew that. And maybe not everybody was devoutly religious, but everybody was familiar with Catholic, you know, the basic Catholic teaching, you know, seven deadly sins and so on and so forth. And everybody attended church pretty much, or it was, let's put it this way, it was considered the mark of a rapscallion to never attend church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just interesting that, you know, the whole thing loses a little bit of power if you don't realize that in the audience's minds and in the characters' minds, they're playing with eternal matters here, you know? Life might be, you know, a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing, but there's something coming after life, so that's not completely postmodern here. You know, Duncan might sleep well after life's fitful fever, but there's heaven and hell. And every time he murders somebody, he mentions that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really just, it loses something when you don't think about that, you know? The finality and the fatality of the whole thing.
That, yeah. You're right. Yikes.
Because by murdering, they just, on principle, would believe that their souls were damned.
Yeah. And he even says that because he, whether or not the grooms actually said this or if it was a figment of his mind, the two grooms were speaking to each other and prayed in their sleep, and one of them said, "God bless us." And Macbeth couldn't say amen after he just murdered. And he said, "Wherefore could I not say amen?" You know, this was a shattering crisis for him that Macbeth doth murder sleep. Well, sleep was an image of death. I mean, that comes out like in four different places. For example, what's his name? Who found Duncan Macduff? He says, "Come, wake up from your sleep and look upon, wake up from death's counterfeit and look at death itself." So sleep is death's counterfeit. Well then, if sleeping is death and death is sleeping, and, you know, Macbeth has murdered sleep, Macbeth is going to hell because he's murdered the sweetness of sleep everlasting. So it's just that whole new layer of oomph in the play that you completely miss because it's not overtly religious. You know, there's no priests in there or nobody really talks about religion much, but it's assumed. And if you don't talk about it and think about it, you lose something.
Well, with a lot of Shakespeare's plays, you really need to know the time period that it's set in.
Right, right.
I mean, there weren't all these different religions that you didn't have free practice, whatever you wanted to practice.
Right.
You didn't pick off the bullet list. Right.
And these were just things that everybody believed.
Well, and everybody knew. Even if they didn't even if it wasn't in their heart a living faith, they assumed that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
Everybody knew about it.
Yep. Very important to understand the cultural, religious, and historical context in which a book is written.
And you just completely killed the very interesting tone that we...
Well, I had to do it sometime. It was interesting, yeah. But we're really out of time any longer. Oh, yeah. And I think, we would have to split it up into two episodes. Anyway, this is a very much a very large encompassing topic, this play of Macbeth. I mean, you guys have taken a whole class on this, and so this this is only a 1-hour podcast. There's only so much we can touch on. So if you enjoyed this, you know, why don't you take a class on it? It's a very, very interesting play to do such, as I'm sure Jolie and Isabel will tell you. All right. Well, thanks for listening to episode... Which episode is this?
Episode, I have no idea.
13? I don't know. Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us again next week, and we will be talking about The Call of the Wild. Please feel free to send us an email at litsotmail@gmail.com. If we get enough of them, we will start reading some of them on the podcast. You can join in our discussion here. Also check us out on our website at litsot.ml. And we are now on iTunes, so go ahead and leave us a rating there if you like what you just heard. Thank you so much. And until next time, books are lighthouses in the sea of time. Bye.